Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. We'll keep following the nuclear crisis in Japan now. Some of the latest info from the Associated Press. This story just moved 4 minutes ago on the AP wire, and it says anxiety and anger are, quote, reaching a boiling point, unquote, in Fukushima, Japan. That assessment comes from the state governor. Conditions at the Fukushima Daiichi nuclear plant appear to have worsened, with white, steam-like clouds drifting from one reactor and radiation levels in the area spiking today. Hundreds of government workers, police officers, and others are struggling to stay on top of the situation in a makeshift command center about 40 miles from the nuclear complex. In an interview with the news agency NHK, the governor, Yuhai Sato, criticized evacuation preparations. He said centers are already packed with evacuees from the neighborhoods closest to the plant and running short on hot meals and basic necessities. Elevated radiation levels have been detected well outside the 20-mile emergency area around the plants. In the state just south of Fukushima, levels had risen to about 300 times normal, but it would take 3 years of exposure to such levels to raise a person's risk of cancer, says the AP. A nuclear safety expert based in Australia says the risks to the general public appear to be low so far, but that expert, John Price, says he is surprised by how little information Japanese authorities are sharing. He says, quote, even the fundamentals of what's happening, quote, unquote, aren't being communicated, adding, we are all guessing. Now, earlier, let's see if I can pull this up, Australia itself, I'm looking for this story. Well, earlier I had read that Australia had, there it is, Australia is advising its citizens in Japan to consider leaving Tokyo and earthquake-affected areas, joining a growing number of governments and businesses telling their people it may be safer elsewhere. Other countries are taking different tacks. The U.S. has not gone that far as yet. With me now for his take is Matthew McKenzie, a senior scientist in the nuclear program with the environmental group NRDC. Thank you for coming on. Welcome to WNYC.
Thank you.
First, what do you make of some of these latest developments that I've just been reading, especially in terms of the danger to public health? Maybe the reassuring part of that latest AP dispatch is that even with these elevated levels of 300 times normal, more than 20 miles from the emergency zone, it would take 3 years of exposure to such levels to raise a person's risk of cancer.
Well, I take issue with that that blanket reassurance. Basically, the safety guidelines in the United States are summarized in an acronym, the ALARA principle. Radiation exposure should be maintained as low as reasonably achievable. That's because radiation dose of any magnitude can produce some level of detrimental effects. The bottom line is that 57 cancer deaths are anticipated for every 100,000, and this is a technical unit, person REM of exposure to radiation. What that means is very low doses of radiation, for example, what has been measured in Tokyo, yes, would not produce radiation sickness, would produce a very tiny elevated risk of cancer death. But that low probability multiplied by the 13 million people who live in Tokyo, it does represent a statistical prediction that some cancer deaths would occur.
What do you make of the information flow? You heard that complaint from the Australian nuclear safety expert saying even the fundamentals of what's happening aren't being communicated. Is that your perception too?
Yeah, I find myself struggling to make sense of sometimes contradictory information and just deal with the very sketchy information that's coming out. I mean, by contrast, during the Three Mile Island accident, the federal government had daily briefings with substantive content on and hard technical details. Japan's also dealing with a wider crisis brought on by the earthquake and tsunami. So, you know, there's There's so much going on.
And Chernobyl was the worst. That was the old Soviet Union. They were so close-lipped about everything. What would you like to be hearing that you're not hearing in terms of information? Do you have specific questions that you feel they could be answering and or not?
I would like to understand more what's happening with the spent fuel pools. It's a separate matter from the four reactor cores involved at Fukushima Daiichi, and how much fuel are in these pools, and how much the cooling at these pools has been compromised. There's been two fires already reported at the spent fuel pool in Reactor Unit 4. I would also like to see more detail, more information on radiation measurements in and around the reactor site. What we're seeing is our spot reporting in the media in Tokyo, in cities between Tokyo and the reactor. Tokyo is about 135 miles away from the damaged reactors, but we're not seeing comprehensive information about where the plumes are traveling.
Do you think that it's an overreaction for people, for some countries to be telling people to leave Tokyo, or for people in Tokyo, which is 135 miles away, to be walking around with masks on, which we hear is happening to some significant degree, or for that matter, on the west coast of the United States, people are starting to buy up potassium iodine? I know, you know, nuclear radiation is a horribly frightening thing and can be so awful and deadly and, you know, grotesque until it's deadly for those affected. But do you think people are having some overreactions here?
Well, I mean, one factor is just the uncertainty in how this will evolve. You know, right now on the International Nuclear Event Scale, it's a six. It's a somewhere between a Chernobyl, a seven, and TMI, a five. Where is it going to move, you know, more towards a seven? There's just a lot of uncertainty. In terms of the United States, Hawaii is about 4,000 miles distant. The West Coast is some 5,000 miles distant. So the radiation would have to travel, you know, over many days to reach the West Coast. The iodine particularly decays fairly rapidly. It has a half-life of 8 days. After 8 days, half of the radioactive iodine has decayed away. So with respect to stockpiling iodine tablets on the West Coast, yeah, that would seem to be an overreaction. If the motivation is the Japanese accident and not the reactors on the West Coast that are in seismically active areas.
Listeners, if you have any questions for Matthew McKenzie, senior scientist with NRDC, we can take a few in this segment. 212-433-WNYC as we continue to make sense of what's happening in Japan. 212-433-9692. And Matthew, our hearts obviously go out to the 50 workers now being hailed as heroes on almost a suicide mission as they try to contain the damage for the greater good. And what an ethical nightmare as they've been withdrawn again to protect them from spiking radiation levels at the plant. Ethical nightmare to send workers possibly to their deaths so thousands more don't get exposed to excessive radiation. Are they doing the right thing in your view, putting them in when they can and then holding them back after certain levels?
Well, the health effects of radiation are a function of the intensity of the radiation and how long you spend exposed to the radiation. So the strategy at Chernobyl was, you know, to send workers in even momentarily to do jobs and then get them back out to limit their exposure. There's very high radiation levels reported at the plant. For example, a radiation level of 40 rem per hour was reported between units 3 and 4. That's a fatal dose in less than half a day. Mm.
What would be the worst case scenario if the workers were not to try? We hear the radioactivity has not reached the general public at dangerous levels so far, as we were discussing. What could happen if they just let the plants die their poisonous deaths?
Well, the heat generated by the nuclear fuel will continue to be substantial for some time. I mean, from the moment you shut off a reactor, the fuel stays hot for For example, about a month after you shut off reactor, the fuel is still about half as hot as it was the day the reactor shut down. So they have to deal with the heat generated by the nuclear fuel for some time yet. And so it's not a situation where efforts can be withdrawn and the situation allowed to just evolve.
We're hearing about the fires and explosions at these reactors. Is there any chance of an actual nuclear explosion where the plant becomes, in effect, a nuclear bomb?
No, there's no chance of a runaway supercritical fission reaction. That's only achieved through the technology of nuclear weapons. It requires different kinds of fissile material than is present in the reactor in different configurations. So you'll see criticality, the release of radioactive material, but not a nuclear explosion.
Of course, people are so intensely interested in and concerned about this situation as we continue to follow it closely. So no surprise to you, I'm sure, that the lines are full. Let's take a couple of listener questions. Milton in Montpelier, Vermont. You're on WNYC. Hi, Milton.
Hi. Hey, thanks for covering this. This is a scary thing.
Indeed.
On a somewhat different perspective, though, I saw some footage on TV that looked like a big natural gas plant. And I know Japan does have a large natural gas power industry that was, like, exploded and on fire and stuff. Do you know anything about that?
In Japan? Do you know where?
Yeah. No, it was just one of those quick blurbs on CNN or something, on
Matthew, I don't know about that. Do you?
Well, I can make it... in general, there are a few other nuclear reactors in the vicinity of Fukushima Daiichi, and those are considered to be in safe, cold shutdown. In terms of natural gas plants, I'm not sure what the status is of ones that were damaged in the earthquake or tsunami.
All right. Let's see. Linda in Verona, you're on WNYC. Hi, Linda.
Hi. My question is, I watch Rachel Maddow at night,
mm-hmm.
and she had something about, she said that the people who run these particular plants have received numerous citations for not honestly reporting things when issues come up. Like, apparently they've had problems in the past and they've played down what was really happening, or, you know, not honestly reported to the public what was honestly happening at the plant. And of course, these were not as serious, but they were things that were supposed to be, you know, reported
right,
to the public. And
so Matthew, are you familiar with that history at this particular plant?
There have been incidents that reflect needed improvements in the safety culture. This particular incident, though, relates more to the fundamental design of the reactor and its ability to withstand this 1-2 punch of an earthquake and tsunami, resulting in what's called a station blackout, where they lost power and lost cooling ability. So,
and I was just going to
bring.
Go ahead. Sorry.
Yeah, which was a factor in TMI and the causal factor at Chernobyl. It doesn't seem to be the issue here, although we don't know a lot about how the backup systems failed and what strategies were taken to prevent what's happened so far.
Linda, thank you for your call. I was just going to ask you about this because people are uncovering the history of these 40-year-old GE reactors, including questions that were raised about their container design back in the 1960s. As being inadequate and even done on the cheap to save money. There's a New York Times article on this today. Do you know that history?
Yeah, these are the boiling water reactor Mark I containment. There are, I think, about two dozen or so similar reactors in the United States, a similar vintage. So this is really going to be an issue for our government to address. Yeah, studies dating back decades said that there was a 90% likelihood that the primary containment structure, would rupture in the event of fuel melting. Loss of wind.
And in terms of the United States and how we should look at nuclear power going forward in light of this, or for the rest of the world, for that matter, Germany has shut down 7 of its older nuclear facilities to take another look before going forward. We had a nuclear safety consultant and former GE vice president, Margaret Harding, and of course GE made these reactors, on the Brian Lehrer Show yesterday, and she very much, you know, supports continuing to develop nuclear power plants despite how bad this is. And she placed it in the context of all the other possibilities. Listen to her recount the alternatives.
I look at the gas explosions that have occurred at operating gas plants that have killed dozens of people. I look at the effect of the coal industry and the people who die from the pollution of coal. And I look at the overall safety of the nuclear industry, even including Chernobyl, on a worldwide basis, is still far safer than any other power source we have when we take those measurements.
How do you want to react to that, Matthew?
Well, it's difficult, you know, to make judgments like that in light of the evolving disaster that's going on in Japan. We don't know the full extent of it, of how it will play out. I mean, there are a lot of choices that go into what you, a government, a country, how a country produces electricity, and there are economic choices and environmental choices, and right now the economics really don't favor nuclear power. It requires pretty massive government subsidies to even get some lukewarm interest in starting up a few reactor projects. They have to compete with natural gas right now. So, you know, there are. The place in the world actually where there seems to be the most potential for growth in nuclear power are in developing countries, especially China. But for the U.S., it's not a strong sell, you know, irrespective of safety issues right now.
Matthew McKinsey, senior scientist in the nuclear program with the environmental group NRDC. Thank you for coming on with us.
Thank you.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC, of course, will continue to follow the developments from Japan throughout the day here on WNYC. Coming up next, though, we will finish out today's program of the Brian Lehrer Show with David Sirota on how the 80s set up our politics and culture of today. Stay tuned.